Well, very good evening to you. Thanks to Ian and the band and to Sandy and Roy at the back there for leading us in time of praise. I don't know how common it actually is today for people to sit down and make out a list of New Year resolutions. Maybe you have done that already, or maybe that's the first of your resolutions that you've broken. You meant to write out a list and it's already the 3rd of January, so that's another one gone. But for a number of years, in fact over 20 years, I have made a list of New Year objectives, and I get together in January with three old friends of mine for a meal, and we review them, we go through them, see which ones we have done, and then we score each other on which ones or how many we think we'll succeed in doing in the year to come. And I mentioned the fact that they are New Year objectives, we call them, because they have to be things that are measurable. Resolutions don't really cut it for us. A resolution such as be nicer in 2010 is all very good, but how do you quantify that? How do you know, really, if you've been successful? However, even with the objectives, my success rate has been pretty mixed. Over the years, there is a lot of cutting and pasting every January as I move last year's objectives onto next year's list. And also quite a number of my objectives each year are kind of perennial ones. It's usually things like climb 10 Monroes or something, and whether I do them or not, I always carry it forward to try and do it again in the subsequent year. Nevertheless, despite my very patchy and not very good record, our objectives, I think there is some value in starting a new year with those kinds of goals. It's been well said that if we aim at nothing, we are likely to hit it. And just as having some thought out and quantifiable goals in business or in sport or perhaps a diet target for 2010 can be helpful motivators and focus points for us as we go into a new year, so also is the case spiritually. And in this regard, I think that objectives rather than resolutions are actually more meaningful and helpful. Because we all want to become more prayerful, don't we? We want to know our Bibles better. We want to be a little bit more servant-hearted. But those things will generally remain pretty vague and pretty woolly unless we have some concrete and measurable steps in place. And further, the beginning of a new year is a good time to plan and to take stock. You see, the year is a God-ordained thing. It is given so that we might measure our lives. In Genesis chapter 1, at the very beginning, God creates the moon and the sun, and one of the reasons he did, as well as giving light, it says in verse 14 is, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. And of course, a year is the amount of time it takes the earth to go round the sun, we all know. But it is the basic unit of measurement that God has given us for our lives that is used frequently in the scriptures. In Psalm 90, we are reminded the length of our days is 70 years. That is how God maps out our lives. It is in units of years, or 80 if we have the strength, yet their span is but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. And in particular, the new year in the Bible was seen as significant. There was a sense then, as there is now, of it marking a fresh start and a new beginning. I've spoken to some people over the holidays, and one or two of them have said to me, we'll be really glad to see the back of 2009. It wasn't a good year for them for various reasons. There is that sense, as we mark off the years, that as one goes, there is a new opportunity, a new start, new hope arises with the start of another year. For some of us, 2010 comes with the great relief or great hope of better times ahead. Well, let me this evening highlight three New Year fresh starts that we read about in the Bible. Three occasions when the first day of the first month had special significance for the people of God. And in doing so, let me sort of draw out something of a precedent that we have in looking at this time of year as being a good time to turn over a new leaf spiritually, or to start afresh in our Christian lives to do better in the months ahead. Well, firstly then, our first example takes us to Exodus chapter 40, because it was, as it were, on the 1st of January, way back in the distant past, that the tabernacle was set up in Exodus. Exodus chapter 40 and verse 17. So the tabernacle was set up on the first day of the first month in the second year. That's the second year of them coming out of Egypt. Then verse 33 says, then Moses set up the courtyard around the tabernacle and altar, and put up the curtain at the entrance to the courtyard. And so Moses finished the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. 1st of January, 2500 and something BC. The tabernacle, of course, was that dwelling place of God among his people Israel, where God dwelt in a very significant and special way. It was the centre of worship for the people of God for all those centuries until the coming of Christ. Its construction at this point in Israel's history completed a great yearning that the people had to have that place where they would meet with God in a very real and tangible way. And the tabernacle is set up, its construction completed, and its ministries commenced on January the 1st. But of course, the tabernacle did not just pop up overnight. It didn't just appear in the evening of the 31st of December, as it were. It actually took the best part of a year for the tabernacle to construct it. But what is significant here in this passage is that its completion date, its opening day, was the first day of the first month. And I don't think that was just happy chance. I don't think they turned up and said, well, what do you know? It's the 1st of January and we're finished. I think it was a very deliberate target on their part. You see, the date marked the first anniversary of Israel's release from slavery in Egypt. They were now a free people looking forward to reaching the promised land. And as they, in that year, in the desert at Mount Sinai, began to think through this new relationship that they were now going to enjoy with God, and as God instructed them in all the details of the construction of the tabernacle and how they were to worship him and how they were to now relate to him, I'm sure that in Moses' mind, as in God's mind, he wanted the people to be tabernacle ready come the 1st of January of that second subsequent year. I'm sure the timelines were put in place during the construction process. The plans were organized so they would achieve this goal. They wanted to begin the year as they meant to go on. They wanted to have the practical means in place to worship God and to serve him properly, to give God his place in the new year, literally, in their case, of course. And I hope we have something of that desire as we start 2010, that we are motivated by something of that thinking. That's why it's good, of course, to organise your Bible reading plan so that you are ready to get going on the 1st of January in the new year. Fortunately, it won't take you a year to print off a Bible reading plan, so it's not too late. There are a whole variety of plans around that you can download on the internet, including ones with catch-up days. So if it's the 3rd of January and you're thinking you've blown it, don't despair. There are some good plans. I've got some here, which I've got copies at the front. There are ones here that give you 25 readings per month, so there's a little bit of inbuilt catch-up time. There are ones which will take you through the New Testament in the first 6 months, and maybe your ambition can be to do that in a year, I don't know. Maybe you'll do it in 3 months. There are various types of plans here. I put links to them on my blog so you can download them or you can pick up a hard copy. It's not too late to want to start the year as you would hope to go on being worship ready. Maybe giving Jesus his place in 2010 will involve a fresh commitment to prayer, a fresh commitment to the church prayer meeting. Or perhaps it will be a commitment to pray at the church prayer meeting. A friend of mine many years ago said he resolved on one occasion never to attend a prayer meeting and not to pray if the opportunity allowed. Maybe that's something that could be an objective for you in the year to come. You see, the prayer meetings in Greenview in 2010, the prayer day next Saturday, will be the real barometer of our spiritual health as a fellowship of God's people. Because the cults can organise. There's nobody more zealous than the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Mormons or the Moonies. They will have activities coming out their ears. But what do we believe about our dependence on God? What do we believe is the source of spiritual power and of ministry success? For others, perhaps being worship ready in 2010, that is making sure that your relationship with God will be properly attended to in the year to come, will have priority, might mean making a commitment to serve in some way, to get involved in an activity, to let go of that reluctance to take responsibility. That desire always to keep your options open. It will mean perhaps for some breaking the attitude of the better offer. You know, stopping that pattern in your life of dropping things and people every time a slightly more attractive option presents itself. Whether that's another person or activity or invitation, because it is paralysing you from making any real difference with your life to anything. Of course, you might be sitting there thinking, well, that was all very well for Israel. They had nothing better to do. There they were sitting in the desert. But I am so busy. Or you might be thinking, you know, Andy, this is all very well, but there are some deep-rooted sins and issues in my life. And I wish it was as simple as downloading an internet plan. But you don't know what's on my plate. You don't know my spiritual hinterland. Well, the new year is a good time to start to address some of those issues too, to take action on some of those fronts. Because the second new year beginning, I want to draw our attention to, is in 2 Chronicles. Many, many years later, after that tabernacle was first constructed, it's now a permanent stone temple. But it was January the 1st again when Hezekiah decided it needed cleaned up. 2 Chronicles chapter 29. Hezekiah was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 29 years. His mother's name was Abijah, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. In the first month of the first year of his reign, he opened the doors of the temple of the Lord and repaired them. He brought in the priests and the Levites, assembled them in the square on the east side, and said, "Listen to me, Levites, consecrate yourself now and consecrate the temple of the Lord, the God of your fathers. Remove all defilement from the sanctuary." Verse 17, they began the consecration on the first day of the first month, and by the eighth day of the month they reached the portico of the Lord, For 8 more days they consecrated the temple of the Lord itself, finishing on the 16th day of the first month. After years of neglect and disrepair, Hezekiah orders a clean-up. The temple in Jerusalem at this stage had seen years, decades of sinful activity. And Hezekiah's clean-up, we can see from these verses, was not just a quick dust and a hoover. It took 16 days, and that would involve quite a team of workers, I'm sure. And that, of course, was just the building. Cleaning up the human heart, cleaning up life is, of course, a lifetime project. Because we know, don't we, that our relationship with God is something that requires constant maintenance. But the point is, again, that the work began at the beginning of a new year. And again, I don't think that's coincidence. I don't think it just happened to be the first free day in Hezekiah's diary. But again, I'm sure it was a deliberate choice, a statement of intent to start a new year afresh, to do things differently in the year to come, to deal with some of the old problems that had been causing so much damage and so much dishonour to God and to the relationship he had with his people. For some of us, it might mean that 2010 is the time to throw out some of the idols that have been cluttering God's space in our own lives. In verse 5, he orders them to remove the defilement. I don't think that was just grime and dirt. I think that would be a reference to the idols and the altars to false gods that had found their way into the temple. The very temple of God in Jerusalem, and they had set up altars to Baal and Asherah poles. Some of those idols, quite apart from the psychological hold they would have held on the people at that time, would have actually been quite valuable just in terms of their cash value. Maybe a new year is the time for some of us to start that work of getting rid of some of the defilement, some of the clutter, some of those things that have crept in to the space that only God should inhabit in our hearts and our lives. Perhaps New Year is the time to scale down your TV package. You know, the one that comes with all those dodgy channels which you just get given but are a besetting sin. And just so you don't think, well, that's going to be a bit awkward to do that, because, you know, the kids like some of the other channels, maybe you could transfer the money you're going to save in the next year by direct debit to a mission organisation or to a missionary. New Year's a good time to start decluttering. Maybe New Year is the time for some to get that history sharing software on their PC. Maybe for others it's a time to resolve to stop buying those trashy gossip magazines that just fill your mind with salacious tittle-tattle. And no matter how much you justify it, are twisting you towards a worldview which is all about superficial beauty and glamour. I'm sorry if this sounds a bit presumptuous, a bit finger-wagging. I hope it doesn't. But if I can put on my pastoral hat for a minute, the one thing you appreciate, don't you, after not that long in ministry and indeed just in life in general, is that sin doesn't have manners. It's not going to politely just get up and go because we've dropped a few hints. It needs to be thrown out. It needs some action. Dealing with sin always involves a certain amount of ruthlessness. If the cross teaches us anything, it teaches us that. It was on the first day of the first month that Ezra left Babylon. chapter 7 and verse 9. Started his journey back to Jerusalem, a journey that took many months. Again, why did he leave on New Year's Day? Was it just the first EasyJet camel train that was available? No, because he saw New Year as that great opportunity to mark a new beginning in his life and in his ministry. He resolved at New Year to take those first steps to seeing God's promises fulfilled in his own lifetime. Let me recommend, as we're thinking about a man who went to go and rebuild a broken down city, let me recommend, just as practical application, a book I was given over Christmas by Paul David Tripp. It's called Broken Down House, Living Productively in a World Gone Bad. That wouldn't be a bad New Year resolution or a New Year objective, to buy this book and to read it. It is full of gold in terms of how we look at life, how we look at ourselves, how we can move forward spiritually, how we can break sinful patterns, how we can start to make progress in our walk with God. I'm going to read a quote of that in a moment or two. Well, thirdly then, because these things can all feel a bit daunting, can't they? Just in case we are in danger of feeling overwhelmed by our weaknesses, the weaknesses that have eaten up so many New Years in the past, so that we despair now of this year being any different, let's just remember that the first day of the first month was not an arbitrary astronomical date for Israel. No, it was the date that was set on their calendar by God back in Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, "This month is to be for you the first month of your year. This is a day you are to commemorate for the generations to come. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance." You see, New Year for Israel in the Old Testament was that annual reminder of God's great rescue and deliverance. Their New Year, as it still is for Jewish people today, was to mark the Passover feast. It was a celebration of God's great power in releasing them from slavery. A celebration that, of course, looked forward to our much greater day of deliverance. Deliverance not from human powers, not from an oppressive regime, but from sin and from guilt and from death itself. Freedom from spiritual bondage. Fresh start, secure not through an animal sacrifice, but through Jesus himself. And so as we start the new year, we want to remind ourselves again of our great hope, of the great truth that should be at the centre of our Christian lives every day, that Jesus Christ himself is our new beginning, is our fresh start. His death is our security. His resurrection is our hope. Every Sunday, as we did this morning, we gather together and we remind ourselves that because of Jesus, we can start not just every new year, but actually, really, genuinely, every day with genuine hopefulness. With fresh opportunities to serve God, to do better, to walk a bit closer, to be more like him. Because in Jesus, of course, nothing can separate us from the hope of heaven or from the love of God. Paul Tripp, in the book I mentioned, in his one of the chapters called Celebrate Grace, puts it like this: a reminder that we want to have day by day, not just at New Year. He says, it's like us waking up in the morning and saying, I'm redeemed, I'm redeemed, I'm redeemed. I can't believe that God has placed his love upon me. No, my life isn't always easy, but I'm redeemed. No, the relationships with people around me don't always work the way they should, but I'm redeemed. Yes, I live in a world that is broken and does not operate as intended, but I'm redeemed. Yes, I face disappointment and suffering, but I'm redeemed. I can't believe it. I am one of God's children. Or, as Paul puts it even more eloquently and wonderfully and memorably at the end of Romans chapter 8, that great passage of hope for us as we start the new year, where he reflects on the fact that nothing can separate us from the love of God, not past or present or future. I love the fact that it says past, present and future, because so many of us wonder if God can love us because of our pasts, wonder if we can really have a relationship with God, wonder if the sheer accumulation of sin that has gone before cannot do anything but surely wipe us out. And God says, not even that which is past, not even your past, your hinterland, your previous failures can separate you from the love of God. And some of us worry that we have staggered on this far to the start of a new year. And we wonder if we can possibly get through another one because we are so acutely conscious of our frailties and our weaknesses, our susceptibility to temptation, and how we have held on by our fingertips, it feels at times. And we think, you know, if we have to go through another year or another decade, I really despair of lasting the course. I really despair of not blowing it big time. I really despair that I'm not going to end up falling away. And God says in these verses, not even the future can separate you from the love of God. Isn't that marvellous? Isn't that great to hear at the start of a new year? Let's close by reading these great verses of assurance. What then shall we say in response to this? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also along with him graciously give us all things? Who will bring any charge against those whom God has chosen? It is God who justifies. Who is he that condemns? Christ Jesus, who died, more than that, who was raised to life, is at the right hand of God and is also interceding for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? As it is written, for your sake we face death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. Knowing all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth or anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. May God grant us in 2010 to be people who flourish in the knowledge and the security of that love and that assurance, and who respond by making those choices, those decisions to move forward and to serve him and to honour him.